All right. Hello, my people. I love you. And welcome to another episode of the Verbal Shenanigans Podcast. We got a great episode coming up, if I don't say so myself. But we got a couple sponsors that make this podcast awesome. Demented Brewing, located in Middlesex, New Jersey, is just an awesome craft brewery that is just growing and doing amazing things each week. They just celebrated a year a couple months ago, and it's amazing what they've accomplished. Go over there. Every Sunday, they release something new. They got a barrel program, a sour program, just an awesome tap room with 16 tap handles, a new beer every Sunday. Like, they just released Hometown Hero, a light Pilsner lager. This Sunday, they're going to be releasing their all-new brown malt liquor. Picture, like, craft brewery taking Old English and making it awesome. At least that's what I imagine, anyway. But go there. Take mom, dad, the kids, whatever. Go there, have a good time. Try their beer. Support them on Instagram. That is dementedbrewing.com. We are lucky enough to have another craft brewery that supports this podcast, and we also support them. That is Manskirt Brewing, located in Hackettstown, New Jersey. Go there. You can visit a couple other breweries while you're at it, and visit Manskirt, located in the old bank building in Hackettstown. Joe Fisher's there. He's the proprietor of Manskirt Brewing. Go check him out in his Manskirt. I'm not kidding. But they have seasonally inspired ales, always doing something new. They have something called, recently, Badunkel Dunk on tap. It's a Dunkelweizen. It's a traditional dark German wheat beer, but it's with roasted grain. They have their winter seasonal coming out. It's a wee heavy with, it's a Scottish strong ale. They're going to age it in some oak barrels, so that's coming up. But go check them out. They always have something going on. It's just a great place to go have a drink and, you know, enjoy company, you know. So go to Manskirt Brewing. I'll give them a like on Facebook, on Instagram, and tell them you heard them on Verbal Shenanigans. Just great people over there at Manskirt. Wolf Nation, wake up, live free. Okay, Wolf Nation is an apparel company for men, women, and children. Just like some real nice, high-end, good quality clothing. Wake up, live free. Basically, that means, you know, get up, do your own thing. Find your own way in the world. Stop being part of the man scheme, paycheck to paycheck, you know. Wolf Nation is what's out. A lot of things coming out in 2017. So please go give them a like. Support an entrepreneur and buy a shirt, damn it. That's Wolf Nation. Wake up, live free. Finally, our good friends at Trivia Revolution. I'm part of the family of Trivia Revolution. I host at Tap House 15, which is where our next Verbal Shenanigans comedy show will be. It's free. Come out, damn it. Don't be cheap. Come see Mike Gaffney rip that room apart. Come see me, you know, if you want. But Trivia Revolution, each week in New Jersey, multiple different craft beer bars in New Jersey. We play a little trivia fueled by craft beer, meaning that you can win prizes to different breweries. Even if you're in last place, you can win prizes to the restaurant you're at and just have a good time with your friends, your buddies. You don't have to be a genius to play, okay? Burglar plays. So what does that tell you? But if you follow on Instagram and Facebook, there's a bonus item each week. You could gain points, earn points. So come on out to Trivia Revolution, fueled by craft beer. Give them a like on Instagram. Get the bonus item. Do it. On this episode of podcast is a friend of mine called Sean, named Sean Lynch. Sean, I worked with him a few times. He's a freaking hilarious comic, but more importantly, just a real down-to-earth, awesome guy. He's a writer, a playwright, a stand-up comedian, but he recently just got added to this new show on AMC called The Walking Dead. Hopefully it'll catch on. We'll see maybe after the podcast. Hopefully they renew it for another season, but the show looks promising. But Sean's going to be playing a character of Max on the show, and I couldn't be more proud for him and happy for him. But listen to him. He's a great interview, and I think you guys will enjoy him. This is Sean Lynch. Enjoy the podcast.
Hey, guys, this is Kane Callis, and you're tuning in to Verbal Shenanigans Podcast. Stay tuned.
But our shenanigans are cheeky and fun.
Yeah, I mean, his shenanigans are cruel and tragic.
Which makes them not shenanigans at all, really.
Evil shenanigans.
I swear to God, I'll pistol whip the next guy that says shenanigans.
Zigzags and Lemons.
That's the name of my band. Yes.
What are you guys playing?
Michael Berlew, Zigzag and the Lemons.
Berlew. Berlew with Zigzag and Lemons here tonight.
Berlew.
Ah, Mike Berlew, welcome back to the Verbal Shenanigans podcast.
Yeah, it's good to be back, man.
Episode 126. Ooh. 126 of these bad boys. Which means that every time I have to come up with some kind of different way to intro the show, or try to do the same thing. Every time I got to come up with a new way to make the sponsors seem cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's not true. The sponsors are cool. I have to try to make it exciting, though.
Yeah. New description.
New
thing. Watch the show, and Berlew will do the following.
Yeah. The last week's was...
Mike Berlew
will dress as a man mule.
Hmm. We have to Google that.
Man, yeah, I don't even know. That could start something new.
Yeah. Are there mantars out there?
Manitars. I was doing trivia this week, and one of the answers was what is half...
half man, half horse, which is actually a centaur.
A centaur.
And basically, I was at the table with Alex and Izzy, and I'm like, I know this. And I knew it ended with a tour, and the first thing that popped in my hand was Manitar.
Manitar.
And then I knew it was bad when you said, one group said.
Well, you know what's even worse? That you said Manitar, and the girls were like, yeah, he's mad. That's got to be right. Not one of you picked out Centaur. Even, like, I would have taken Minotaur, like a mess up.
That's why I was close on. And then I was trying to figure out that one came from, and I found out it was an old WWF wrestler who came to the ring wearing a buffalo head.
So, yeah, the fact that all three of you agreed on Manitar is even better.
Yeah. I'm going to have to call up Kevin Garifo, see if I can talk to Manitar.
That'd be awesome. I'm sure he's dead.
No, he's pretty fat. So, well, he could be dead for fatness' sake.
First off, if it's a wrestler, it's like a 50-50 shot that they're dead, you know.
Or racist like Hulk Hogan.
Yeah. Hulk Hogan's not racist. He's still an American hero.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That stuff about, you know, everybody's a little racist, those effing N-words.
That's just Hulkamania talking. Sometimes it gets a little wild.
He forgot
wild.
His vitamins that day, huh?
Sometimes it gets a little wild and the train gets let out of the station. No big deal.
That was a weird thing that popped in his head when he was saying his prayers. What's that, Lord, brother?
So, Berlew, the Cubs won the World Series.
Yeah.
Donald Trump's going to be president after tomorrow.
I still don't think so.
I don't think so either, but I think there's a legit shot of him winning this thing.
He's got a way better shot than it looked like 2 weeks ago. But looking at the maps, from what I understand, there's like five swing states, and he'd have to win all five in order to win the election.
I just think there's a lot of people that aren't even saying they're voting for him. They're like closeted Trump guys, and they're going to come out in full force tomorrow.
Yeah, but you also got to remember...
I'm also hoping I'm wrong, but...
Yeah, I mean, for most of those states, when they say, you know, Democrat or leaning Democrat, it would take millions of people to show up. Not just like, hey, an extra 1,000 people showed up for Trump.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, we'll see. Either way, I don't really care. I'm just happy to... Maybe have my Facebook feedback to be more like...
No, because then you're going to get a month of, it was too close, and here we found out three votes weren't counted in Utah, blah, blah, blah. And then we're going to get to January, and I'm so happy, woman president. I'm so sick, she rigged the election.
Yeah, but I hope like at least some of it will go away. Even if it gets cut by like 25%, I'll be happy. Because at this point, it's every, I would say two out of three posts are something, some stupid political thought.
And it's mostly Rich McDonald, pointed out.
Yeah. I know we've said this before, and even like, I'm sick of talking about it, like, to you, even, like, just to anybody, really. Like, even we went away to Lake George this weekend, we were talking, and, like, even Alex was like, let's just not talk politics. And I'm like, you're right. You know, like, it's just, it's so
no
bad.
Reason to.
I just want our lives to go back to normal, where we realize that nothing's going to really change anyway.
No.
Not immediately. But I just wish people would check the sources of the things they post. They're getting more and more ridiculous. It's like, Hillary supports a rape circle of 13-year-olds. The Clinton Foundation funded a rape train. You know, like, it's like, okay.
Donald Trump casinos were run by KKK members bent on bringing back Hitler to life. Yeah.
Donald Trump actually killed the Native Americans himself to build a casino on their land. Like, it's like, okay, I get it. They both suck horrendously. Mm. But just check your sources. When the source says conservativedailyeagle.com, it's like, obviously, it's going to say Barack Obama is the source of all evil. He funded ISIS, and Hillary's the worst.
I was waiting for where you're going with it. He's the source of orally something.
Of oral evil. Ooh. Oral evil. But, yeah, I can't read it anymore. I'm done. I'm so done. I haven't even decided if I'm going out to vote tomorrow. I haven't decided.
I will, and it's still between Gary Johnson or Zoltan Mistyman.
Is he even on the ballot, Zoltan?
I'll just write him, man. Yeah. I don't care. I mean, the odds on him being on the ballot, I mean, I hate to say it. I mean, I loved interviewing him. I enjoyed his ideas. But the actual needing of an amount to actually be one of those things you select, probably not.
For me, it comes down to a politician is a politician. They had to step on people's shoulders and all these other things to get into that point. It's a job built on lying and built on pleasing people that are going to get you to the next step and to the next step and to the next step until the. Think about it. The politician itself is based on pleasing people to vote for you. Mm-hmm. So coming up with a way for people to vote for you. So right from the start, it's about selling yourself and advertising yourself and making you look better than the other option. It starts from the local government. Mike Burlow's running for Freeholder or something like that. It starts there. You have to be better than the next guy.
I'm running for being a city.
We still should have done mock ads like Mike Burlow, bad boy, like us against each other for something.
Maybe later on.
Never too late. It'd still be funny.
Never too late. It'd be fun.
Yeah.
Something near the inauguration.
But it's a career based on lying and building yourself up and false advertising and, like I said, exaggerating things you've done and, you know, hiding things that you've, you know, every politician probably has a million things they flip-flopped. That's the other thing. They hold these people to standards like, Hillary said this in 1993. Well, Burlow, were your viewpoints exactly the same in 1993 than they are now?
Well, in 93, I was going, yay, John Kruk, so probably things changed. Is he still out there? I know he got fired from me. He actually might be a booth announcer for the Phillies.
Yeah? Oh, yeah? What about they should hire Kane, Kane Callis.
Kane Callis? That'd be cool.
Yeah, bring his son in.
I want to steal, but he keeps on saying hold.
Hold. But, King Callis was Harry's son that we had on the podcast, for all you wondering, for all you massive listeners.
Episode, I had to guess, 89?
I don't know. But, it's just, I don't know, what was I just saying right before that? Before King Callis came up?
We were just talking about how all the politicians, their whole job is trying to please you versus actually being what you want them to be.
Yeah. So, in the end, I'm waiting for it to be done. Mm-hmm. I just want it over with. I never want to, I don't know, like, it's, I want to go back to, like, people hating each other for who they like in sports or whatever, you know, like, hating, these people hate each other over, it's like, so what if you disagree? Isn't that what we're supposed to do? Like, like, isn't that what makes this country great? Blah, 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 blah. You know, like, I don't know. I'm sick of it. I'm done.
Yep.
Over. Political rant over.
All right.
For today.
Cool.
Yeah. Cubs won.
Yeah.
I was kind of happy, I guess. I was rooting for the Indians. I said that. I love Terry Francona. Some of the stories you hear about Francona are hilarious. Like, the things he says to players. They're... I forget who was telling me. It might have been Joe. Obi, what do you want? Hold on.
Fill the air.
Yeah, I mean, it was a great game 7. It was very tense. It was back and forth. It looked like the Cubs were going to blow them out. The Indians started slowly coming back. Then we had all that drama with the rain delay and Madden putting in Chapman for like the 75th inning in a row. Which
probably one of the best game 7s, if not the best.
Definitely up there.
But yeah, so I think Joe was saying it, or maybe he said it on his podcast. I don't know. But like, I forget who it was. One of their players back on the Red Sox days was known to be super slow or something and got thrown out on like a double. Like, he like got thrown out on a play that he should have been at like third for at second, mm-hmm. and like Francona or something said like, "Have you been checked for polio lately?" Like, something. He just seems like an awesome. I love Joe Maddon too. Those are actually my two favorite managers in baseball. Maddon made some interesting calls going down the stretch there. He seemed like he was getting the crazy. Moment was getting too big for him for a second.
Yeah, I guess he was so close to the end goal that he was just panicking, like, "Oh, let me do this, let me do that." I mean, I brought up the Chapman thing. Everybody's screaming out. And who knows how good it'll be next year? Because all these closers, the second you say go an inning and a half, they're just like, my ACL,
everything,
Tommy John."
I think one of the biggest reasons for the whole Tommy John thing is, I think the guys never give their body a break. They're training specific muscles so down to the point that. That's why you get all these oblique tears and stuff like that. They're lifting way more weight than these guys used to. They're lifting all season long. You know, I also think part of it is because these kids are playing. They make them play one sport, right? Mm-hmm. From the time they're nowadays, sometimes from like sixth grade on, if not earlier, sometimes, and they're playing one sport. Whereas when you were an average kid, a good athlete, you'd play a million sports and then eventually find your niche. Like, eventually it would weave into one sport. So you had muscle training and all different, you know, all tendons. The way, like, I coach soccer. Like, I sometimes love having kids who play basketball and lacrosse because they move differently. Like, they're very coachable, and they become some of my best defenders. Just the way they move. It's an instinct from something else. They can move
in a different way than what everybody's used to.
Yeah. So my theory is that a lot of these kids are so, you know, specialized into one thing, throwing, hitting, whatever it is, that they're not being built up the same way. They're overtraining. And think about it. Like, back in the day, Mike Berlew was a pitcher during the season, but then he might be an insurance salesman after the season's over, you know? Like, your body had a natural rest, you know? So I think it's just overtraining.
Well, I think it also comes down to over-specialization. Now every player out there is like, no, you're a seventh-inning left-handed pitcher.
A loogie.
And then they come into the playoffs in weird situations where it's like, oh, we got a clinch a game. Coming in the third inning. Ten pitches. And they just don't know what to do, and they panic.
I also think that a lot of these guys back in the day pitched through these injuries and didn't report them because it was so – this was their paycheck. Like, before it was – Berlew, you're guaranteed $3 million. Okay, I don't care if I pitch. I got enough money sitting in the bank. Back then, where you're earning money, where it wasn't like this crazy earning potential, where you needed that paycheck to live. That's another theory of mine, that they were playing through these injuries. Everything wasn't reported. There wasn't insurance policies out on your legs and your elbows and your knees and all that stuff. So that's how you earned your money, going out there.
Speaking of which, did you hear about the catcher for the Cubs? He's already crying that he didn't have enough playing time in the World Series.
Oh.
Yeah. Montero. I mean, everybody's excited. 108-year curse finally over. Cubs finally win. You got a World Series. His next year contract is $12 million, and he already got on a radio station. He's like, well, they didn't really tell me they're going to reduce my role in the World Series, and that really bummed me.
Be bummed when you're not on the team next year. I would just be like, get out of here.
You got the most prestigious. You basically, anytime he goes into Chicago, he'll never have to buy a drink. He'll never have to buy a meal. No. He'll forever be out there. You could be the fourth,
possibly the most prestigious championship in baseball history, just because of the length.
Yeah, and he's sitting back going, "Oh, well, Joe Maddon didn't discuss to me that I wasn't going to start and have a certain amount of innings."
Yeah.
It's like, dude, you got the ring and you got $12 million next year. Shut the hell up. If you don't like it, you leave the team next year or ask him for a trade.
Yeah. Theo Epstein, guy is just Hall of Famer right now. Mets, once all this thing goes down, if Theo wants to come over to the Mets, he's more than welcome.
He should just say, fuck it, and just like, I'm going to take over the Cleveland Browns.
Well, you know who is the GM of the Cleveland Browns?
Who's that?
Paul DePodesta, the Mets assistant GM from last year, which explains, let's bring in this great baseball man to manage our football team. There is the Cleveland Browns philosophy in life.
Mm-hmm.
He was the Moneyball guy. He was with Billy Beane. He was like his assistant, the guy who
Yeah.
Jonah Hill plays in, mm-hmm. in Moneyball. But let's shift.
I don't know if like football can really go to that kind of level. I mean, the mathematics alone.
Yeah, I don't know either. The math thing sometimes, the sabermetrics gets a little crazy. It does make sense.
It makes sense in baseball because it's so individualized. You can sit back and say, oh, that's a situation where I want that guy because he can bunt a ball X amount of times in these scenarios. But football, it's like, kill the man.
Theo Epstein should just pick the next team that has the biggest Indians. Gap and be like, who is it? Indians. Yeah, the Indians. Yeah, be like, all right, I'm available, and just go from team to try to bust every slump, you know. Cool story. My boss grew up down the street from the Indians general manager, who is Mark Chernoff's son from WFAN. Mark Chernoff is the head of like programming and everything.
Oh, okay.
And they had a really cool article. His son and him, Chernoff, who's like older, every month they make it a point they have to play catch every month for like an hour or whatever. And like they've literally like they'll like double up on weekends if it's like a split month and you know they're busy. They'll make sure they play 2 days. They'll fly in just to play catch. One time they had to do it in the back of like a parking lot and they play catch and like they stick to it. Like a really cool story because they've done it since they were kids. Like he was a kid. But yeah, 34-year-old guy, general manager of the Indians. Like, just went to school, just got like an internship for the Indians and worked his way all the way through. Pretty inspiring. But we got to shift gears real quick.
All right.
We can come back. Comic I work with a couple times. His name's Sean Lynch. Very funny dude. One of Mark Riccadonna's good friends. He's done a lot in comedy. He headlines. He writes. He's always working on something. And he's a super down-to-earth dude. And he actually just recently got a role on The Walking Dead.
Ooh.
The Walking Dead.
Never heard of
that. Yeah, never heard of it. So we'll see what it's all about. He'll maybe promote the show. Maybe we can get that show a couple views. You know. But let's get Sean Lynch on.
Hey, Andrew Lincoln. We heard.
Well, anyway. Yeah. Well, let's give you a proper welcome here because we just hit record on the recorder. I met Sean Lynch at the prestigious Comedy Loft with him and Mark Riccadonna. I came into the city. Mark was about 27 drinks deep, I think. But I met Sean. Sean is a you can't hear?
No, you went really loud there for a minute.
Oh, I'm loud.
Yeah.
But yeah, Sean is a comic, writer, actor, another pale-skinned individual. But Sean, welcome to the prestigious Verbal Shenanigans podcast.
Oh, it's good to be here. In spirit.
So, Sean, were you, did you start in stand-up or did you start in acting?
No, I actually, I guess you could say I started in acting. Like, I started doing acting professionally when I was a little kid. You know, I got discovered by some PBS guy named Dave Charette when I was in the fourth grade. I did some sketch at a school show, and he said to my parents, you know, that kid should be in an acting school. And my father was like, absolutely not. You know, and my sisters and my mom pitched together their own money so that I could go to an acting school when I was a kid.
Your sisters helped you go to acting
school? Yeah, they were still in college. Like, wow. They were literally like pooling their money together with my mom to pay for my first year of acting school at the Children's Academy of Performing Arts when I was like in the fourth grade or so. And
that's quite a family.
I got four older sisters and an older brother. I got a big Irish brood of a family. So they thought I belonged, you know, on stage. So they paid for my first year, and then eventually my father acquiesced and paid for the next couple of years at the school. And I started doing theater professionally when I was probably about 14, doing little productions with like a Boston repertory company and stuff. And Then when I was about 15 or 16, I did a high school play called Our Town. I'm sure everybody's fucking done Our Town. I mean, it's something, yeah. But when I did that play, I realized I was really blown away by how good the writing was in that play, and I decided I don't want to be an actor. I want to be a playwright. So I decided I wanted to write a play. So while I was in high school, I wrote a play called A Question of Life, Love, and Puberty. And that play ended up getting into the Young Playwrights Festival in New York in, what was it, 89? Something like that. And then these guys who both worked for Playwrights Horizons Theater and a theater tract at NYU called the Playwrights Horizons Wing, pursued me and said, hey, you know, if you want to study playwriting and directing and stuff, we have a track at NYU, you know, maybe you might be interested in that. And at the time I was kind of deciding whether to go to Juilliard to study music or to go to NYU to study theater, and I ended up going to NYU to study playwriting. And my whole goal in life at that point, especially in the early 90s, was you know, to go to NYU and be a playwright. And that had been my whole goal. I wanted to move to New York and be a writer. And then in the summer of 1992, I had a play running in the New York One Act Festival, and it was there that I met Rick Crome, who at the time was the host of the Comedy Cellar. He was like a pretty regular host there. And he was like, "Well, you're a very funny young man. You should try doing stand-up." And I was like, "Take my wife, please, and rainbow suspenders, man. That's corny. No way." But he was like, "Well, if you come by the cellar and come watch a show, you know, I think you'll see it can be pretty cerebral." And then he also said I could get free beer, which at 19 was like, oh, man, yeah. Sold.
Come on, at 19.
So,
that still works today.
Yeah. So I spent the summer of 1992 just going to the Comedy Cellar a couple of nights a week to watch Rick host. And I got to watch like a young Mark Maron, young Dennis Leary, Colin Quinn, all these great comedians, you know, Rick Shapiro and all these other Sarah Silverman perform. And, you know, by the end of the summer, I'd gotten to know a few of them, and I thought, wow, stand-up's pretty cool. But I hadn't really decided that I wanted to do stand-up. And then one night in like August of 92, Rick sandbagged me and was like, he got up at the end. There's probably maybe 17 people in the audience. It was like a Tuesday night. And Rick said, "Oh, the last comedian for the evening is a young playwright from New York University. He lives around the corner. Please give it up for Sean Lynch." And I'm sitting there in the back with like Jay Moore and Rick Shapiro and everybody like, "You better get your ass up there." And I was like, so I got up on stage and started rambling because I had nothing prepared. And I started talking about how much my roommate at NYU masturbated. And I used some weird metaphor about how focused he was on masturbating. And it got a huge laugh, and it was like that first line of cocaine. It was like, oh, I get it. Oh, okay, I see. And then I started, you know, telling some more jokes and talking about living in the dorms, and that was my first set. And after that, I was pretty much hooked.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty awesome. That's funny that he threw you to the wolves like that. I like that.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you need that, you know, I guess. And, you know, slowly but surely, I started doing sets once in a while back when you could at that level do a set once in a while at the Comedy Cellar. And then eventually I started doing sets at the Boston Comedy Club. And then I started doing sets pretty regularly around the East Village while I was in college. But I still consider myself to be, you know, like a playwright who occasionally did stand up, and I certainly enjoyed doing it. but I never thought it was a way that I could make a living. Certainly not like the other people that I was watching. You know, I consider myself to be like a tourist.
Now, when did you get to the point where you threw everything, like where you did this just as a living, like you did?
And well,
was that from the beginning,
ended,
or
What ended up happening was I got a few more plays produced in New York while I was at NYU, and it was actually going pretty well. I got a few plays produced at the Harold Clurman Theater and the Theodore Rowe Theater and the Playwrights Horizons Theater and the Gene Frankel Theater, and it still looked like, all right, I'm going to be a writer. This could actually happen. And then about a week before I graduated from NYU, this guy Justin Foran, who was a producer at the Daily Show, this back when Craig Kilborn was hosting it, saw me one night at the Boston Comedy Club, and he was like, hey, you know, I'm doing this industry show in 2 weeks, and you know, I didn't know what that meant, but he was like, I'm doing this industry show in 2 weeks, and you know, you've got great energy, I'd love to have you open the show. And I said, well, where's that? He said, it's this club called Stand Up New York. And I'd never performed above 14th Street before, so that seemed like a new adventure. So I said, okay, sure, man, I'll do it. And what I didn't know was that at the show that I was going to be performing at, there was a lot of agents and casting people and blah, blah, blah. It was like some big industry showcase. And I guess it was good for me that I was completely ignorant as to what it was. Because, you know, I went up there, I did my whole set about how fucked I was being a guy graduating from NYU with a playwriting degree, and
right.
I was probably going to, you know, wind up broke, sucking dick on Christopher Street, you know, or...
And it happened. Like,
that's the goal in everybody's life.
It wasn't going to end well, you know, and just the whole thing, I started talking... I mean, I wouldn't even say I was doing a bit. I was really just trying to be... honest about how screwed I was going into this industry. And the irony is, I get off stage and I'm sitting at the bar, and I think I was there, like Todd Barry and Jeff Ross and a couple other guys were sitting there at the bar who were guys that I considered to be pretty successful guys. They were in their 30s at that point, and they had been on TV and you know, they'd done a thing or two, and I considered them to be like, wow, those guys are like real comedians, you know? And as I'm sitting there at the bar, this guy, Brian Stern, and this guy, Mike August, walked over to me, and they said, hey, how you doing? We're from the William Morris Agency. We were wondering if you have anybody representing you. And I didn't know what that meant. I was like, no, I represent myself, I guess. And they said, you know, have you ever thought about doing voiceovers? You do a lot of voices and blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, does it pay money? You know, sure. You know, that sounds okay. And so they gave me their card and they moved on. They left. And about a half an hour later, this woman, Karen Apicella from Frontier Booking International, was like, hey, you know, I'm an agent and I blah, blah, blah. Da, 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 da. Okay. I took her card too. And then towards the very end of the evening, when I was pretty hammered, eventually this older F. Murray Abraham looking dude comes over to me in a Yankees cap and a suit jacket, and he's like, hello, Sean, my name's Kerry Hoffman, this is my club, you know, welcome, I want to talk to you about management. And I said, oh, that's cool, man. I mean, I've never managed a comedy club, but I definitely need a job. As you can tell, I'm about to graduate and I have no fucking job. And he's like, oh, no, I manage certain comedians at the time. I think he managed like Lynn Coplitz and Zach Galifianakis and Tom Hertz, a couple other people. But in that one night, I'd managed to land like an agent, a booker, and a manager. And, the other comedians at the bar were like, dude, that never happened.
must have been a solid set.
I guess. I don't know. I don't remember much. But I remember running downstairs because there was a payphone by the bathroom downstairs. And I remember calling my mom and going like, hey, I think everything just worked out. I I think I might have representation. My mother didn't know what any of that meant, but you know, she was enthused that I was enthused. And then all of a sudden, within like a week or two of graduation, I had an agent and a manager, and I was doing TV stuff like commercials and, you know, the other, you know, some other shit.
That's pretty awesome. That's a solid night in your life right there.
Yeah, it was cool, man. It was weird because now, you know, literally 20 years later, I look at how most comics come up and I'm like, oh God, yeah, it's a fucking hard road, man.
Yeah.
Cause, you know, usually it's like you're punting for months and years and whatnot and waiting for somebody to find you. And I just happened to be there on a night where people were looking. And so, you know, I guess I kind of lucked out in that aspect. And for a couple of years there, I kept trying to keep the playwriting thing going because I would take the money that I would make from doing commercials and voiceovers and bit parts and films, and I would pump that into a theater company that I created with a couple of friends of mine. And we would produce the plays based on the money that I would make from these commercials and voiceovers that I would do. And then eventually I had to move out to Hollywood in 98, 99, and went out there and was completely disillusioned by how shitty everything was. And and turned to my best friend's whiskey and cocaine to burn it all down.
So you're back. You're back on the East Coast now, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm jumping back and forth. I mean, I'm living part time in New York, part time in Atlanta, and a wee bit part time in LA. Because right now I'm trying to lay some foundations for some new jobs that I have going, and I'm trying to slowly work my way out of New York. I mean, not all the way. But I'm trying to make sure that I'm only in New York for maybe 5 days a month, just doing some sets and doing some voiceover work.
Right.
And that my main base is Atlanta, and that I'm trying to get this new cartoon show started in L.A. So I have to go out there for a couple days a month just to groom my future bosses for for that endeavor. And so I'm kind of living like a gypsy, which is weird at 44.
Well, you said you're in Atlanta now, and that's definitely one of the things I wanted to talk about. We were talking before the show at that place, John and Peter's in New Hope, which was that room has some kind of magic in it, man. I loved every second of that set. I mean, I got there. I'm like always on time. I got there at 8:30 because the poster said 9 o'clock show. I mean, we didn't start till like 10:30, but every minute of that set just felt fun, and the room is just intimate, and like it's so interesting.
It's magic.
The boots just
it's
like
got a wee bit of magic in it. I don't know what it is,
but I loved it. I told Mike I would do that room anytime.
It's so eclectic, that room. It's so. It's electric and it's eclectic, and there's some weird thing that makes you want to experiment.
Oh.
And it makes you want to get really loose, and it's, yeah, I love it. Well, I mean, it's one of my favorite rooms in the country.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. I was like talking to my buddy Joe right before that. We were like walking our dogs like the day before, and like I had a couple like blah kind of shows and sets, and I'm like, oh, I'm doing this place in New Hope. I'm like, I'm hoping it's kind of like a loose kind of rock club kind of vibe. And that's exactly what it was. And I felt like so loose on stage there. It was just like a very cool vibe. I don't know. It was just like one of those shows that sticks out of my mind. Like, you know, even if there is like a small amount of people, it's just the room is so cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's definitely, I always see people kind of pushing their envelope there. I mean, I've been doing that room now for about 3 years. And every time I do the room, no matter who it's with, I always see people just pushing as hard as they can, not pushing in a desperate way, but pushing in a, hey, I can do whatever I want. Oh man, okay, I'm gonna try this.
But we were talking behind the restaurant. You were talking about Atlanta. Now, we'd be greatly remiss if we didn't bring up that you recently got cast in The Walking Dead.
Yeah, isn't that crazy?
That is unbelievable, man. First and foremost, congratulations. That's
no, thanks.
That is unbelievably awesome.
Yeah, it's cool. I've been such a fan of the show for such a long time. It's really cool to be a part of it. You know, to be a part of Robert Kirkman's imagination. That's really kind of an honor, because I love the way he writes. I mean, I love the story arcs of his comic book, and I love the way that he and Frank Darabont created the pilot, and I love what Gail Ann Hurd has done with the pilot since, over the past 6 years. I mean, yeah, it's pretty cool, man. It's cool. What's cool is to be simultaneously working on the show and the video game.
Oh, nice.
Which is neat. Yeah,
that's
Max
cool.
Max is actually a real pivotal character in the new video game, and depending on what choices you make in the game, Max can either be your best friend or your worst enemy, or it's pretty neat.
That's awesome.
And,
that's a Telltale series.
Yeah, it's a Telltale series.
They make.
We're actually,
ones.
You know what's crazy, man, is this video game I've been working on since June, and it was supposed to launch at Halloween, and yet this week I've been doing more voice work on it. And I guess they're pushing it back to Christmas. And I can't imagine, Jesus, how much money they must have for this project to be able to push it back. Because I know what happens when you push things back in television or film, people get fired.
Yeah.
But there's so much money in these video games now. And I've been working in video games for 16 years now. I mean, I was one of the original voice guys for Grand Theft Auto. I mean, nice. That was while I was still doing Celebrity Deathmatch, and it's changed so much, the whole scale and scope of video game voice work, not only in terms of the pay, but just in terms of the way that it's divvied out. I mean, back when we did Grand Theft Auto 3, it was like you got $1,500 for the day, and you knocked out all your voice work in that day, and you never saw another penny.
Right.
And, you know, fair play. You're like, well, $1,500, great. But then you'd see how well the video games would do, and you'd be like, shit. And now, because of a couple of well-placed SAG strikes now, for video games, if you're a lead in a video game, you're getting $425 an hour per day.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah, dude. And I'm only getting like $800 a day for the TV show. So, of course, every time they want me to work on the video game, I'm like, fuck yeah.
So, yeah. Take us to the beginning, though. How did you get the role, like, on Walking Dead?
Well, here's the interesting thing is it started off with the video game.
Oh, no shit, really?
I was doing the Telltale Games video game, and I started doing that in June. And you know, that was fun, and I knew that it was one of the bigger parts in the video game. And so I'm working forward on that, and then, you know, I started finding out that they may actually be arcing some of the people from the Clementine storyline into the video into the television show. And then one thing led to another, and the craziest thing was I had several ties to the television show just through friends of mine in Atlanta, you know, like Danny Donovan and his wife Jen, who now are the owners of the new improv there in Atlanta, were friends with Robert Kirkman and a lot of the other cast members, because they used to go to his bars, Prohibition the Whiskey Mistress. And then I also went to college with the actress that plays Michonne. She went to NYU. Yeah, and I agree. And anyway, there were several different things happened where they ended up coming and seeing me do a set and blah blah blah. And next thing you know, they were working Max and Clementine and whatnot into this new arc of it's crazy how it came together. I mean, it really. You know, I'd love to say, oh, that all came together. You know, I did something interesting and blah, blah, blah. Now, a lot of it's luck.
Yeah.
I mean, so much of this business is luck. But I always like what I always say to younger comedians is that you can shrink the odds. Well, you can shrink the odds if you're always putting yourself out there.
Yeah, meeting people.
If you're always meeting people, if you always have a project going on, if you always, and you know, God knows, over the past couple of years, I've had a bunch of independent films out there that I've written or directed or acted in, and I've been doing the road relentlessly for the past 3 years, and every once in a while, you know, the tide and the moon line up, and next thing you know, something good happens.
So can you, okay, without, go, I know you told us you're on episode 7 and 8 of this season. You said
7. I do a wee cameo in episode 7, so I'm trying to light a cigarette. I do a wee cameo in episode 7. But then the arc really starts around episode 9.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right.
Because as you started to see, if you watch the series at all this season, it jumps around a bit.
Yeah. Well, the last few seasons definitely do that. It's like every episode is the different storyline, it seems like. They're following.
Right. Yeah. And what they're trying to do right now is they're trying to show Ezekiel's kingdom, and they're trying to show Alexandria post Negan, and then there's Negan's base of operations, where called the Sanctuary, which is where the Saviors operate, which is where Max operates. And but here's the true part of the story is I'm not allowed to tell you jack shit happens plot wise.
Yeah, I was about to say, like, how airtight. I'm shocked you can even tell us what episode you're on. How airtight of a contract is it to say
airtight enough that I had to sign a phone book size agreement when I took the deal. And, you know, they'll take your phones in the morning at breakfast and they'll give it back as you're getting your car ride back. You know what I mean? Like, it's I get a locked iPad with only my pages of dialogue on the screen the days that I'm shooting.
that's amazing.
And well, I think with the Twitter sphere being what it is,
of course,
you have to keep things as tight as
possible. Big as that show is, you know, like people are fiending for any little clue of anything, you know, like now, like, did you with like the first episode, if this is spoiling it for everyone, I'm sorry. We're 4 episodes in at this point, 3 episodes in. But like, did you know like who got killed in the show? Glenn and Abraham? Did you know that?
I'll tell you what's interesting. One of the first people that I got to meet, of the cast was Michael Curtis, who plays Abraham.
Yep.
Which was a huge bummer because, like me, he drinks whiskey, and like me, he smokes cigars, and I just thought he was the coolest thing since, you know, sliced bread. And when he was the, you know, when he was one of the first people killed, that was a bit of a bummer. But you know, there's people in the cast I still haven't met. There's people like, because remember, I'm only allowed to hang out or work with the people that are in the immediate scene that I'm in. So yeah, it's very locked off.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
but I'm like literally not allowed to talk about it.
Yeah. Like, my parents live right down by where they shoot a lot of stuff. They live in Sharpsburg, Georgia.
And
And they keep on telling every days, like, my dad's retired, but there would say when he would come home from work and there'd be like a roadblock and he's like, oh, they're shooting Walking Dead over there. And they talked about how they purposely bought studio land down there, but they didn't use like their real names just because they knew it. They knew the Walking Dead was buying the property.
Yeah, you're gonna get a crowd.
That is, number one, you're gonna get a crowd, and number two, they're gonna jack up the price knowing you need the land.
Yeah, well, especially now with the budget they have. Yeah, I mean, they have to. Everything is so secretive and everything is so locked down. I mean, it's weird. But I mean, I accept it. You know, whatever. I mean,
hell yeah, you accept it.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what? I gotta tell you. At my age, my whole thing is, as long as the check's clear, I'm good. Do you know what I mean?
Dude, like, you should be proud. Nah, don't have that flaw. You should be proud of, dude, you've had a lot. I mean, just talking to us now, 20 years of working playwrights, voiceover, comedy. You should be proud. You just landed a role in a show that's going to be remembered for a long time, and who knows how long it'll go. You should definitely be excited and proud of that, man.
From your lips to God's ears, cowboy. It's interesting, and it's kind of cool. I mean, one of the things that I really liked about moving down to Atlanta, and one of the things that I liked about, you know, about staying down there is, you know, you live in New York for 25 years, you kind of get locked into certain things. And what's nice about traveling, A, through comedy, and B, being able to live someplace else for a while, is to a certain extent, you're kind of able to reinvent yourself.
Right.
You know, you're kind of able to, I don't know, take yourself away from certain things that maybe you're not as happy with. I mean, I know for me, what was nice was about going down to Atlanta, and especially doing comedy in Atlanta and working down there, is I don't have any of the stuff that I'm always trying to shake away from myself, which is my reputation of being like a party animal and, you know, being like, oh yeah, Lynch, he's a real funny guy, but sometimes he'll vomit on the stage. Or, you know,
like, hey, that's my bit.
A fight with the bouncer, or sometimes he'll, you know. Mm. I mean, some crazy stuff that I did when I was in my 20s and early 30s that,
right,
you know, I've been spending the past couple of years trying to dispel. When I got down to Atlanta, there was none of that. It was just, hey, he's that guy that's on The Walking Dead, and he's a funny comic. And, you know, so I could kind of, I don't know, recalibrate myself and start going to the gym and start getting into eating healthier and losing weight and all this other shit that I'd been wanting to do in New York. But I get so locked into that reputation of being like the John Belushi of, you know, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, you've done shows with me. Like, people expect me to get a little hammered and a little crazy and a little, you know, wild. And I'm definitely happy to do that in the moment when I'm on stage. But sometimes when I get off stage, I just want to be able to be mellow and hang out and have a cigarette and not be, I don't know, whatever my rep precedes.
Kind of like a release from the act, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, really. Because it's kind of exhausting. You know, when people, I mean, it happens sometimes. It sometimes happens even when I'm, doing shows, especially when I'm doing shows at colleges or when I'm traveling around. And, you know, sometimes I'll finish doing a show and there'll be a bunch of frat boys that are waiting for me after the show. And they're like, hey, man, let's do some shots. Let's get crazy. Let's get arrested like you did in L.A. Let's, and, you know, let's
get arrested.
Like three shots of. And, and I'm like, well, you know, those stories are 15 years old. Okay. But, like, I had an incident that just happened to me in Albany. I was just headlining a show in Albany, and this guy who'd come out to a couple of shows before brought me two space cookies. And I don't think I need to explain to you what a space cookie is. But he had brought me these two delicious space cookies wrapped in foil. And he came up to me about a half an hour before the show, and he was like, hey, man, I made these for you. I don't know if you remember me. And I was like, oh, no, I remember you. You were the guy who had the tie-dye at the blah, blah. He was wearing a tie-dye shirt again. And I was like, yeah, I did that whole bit about you and I, like, going to see the Grateful Dead and da-da-da-da. Oh, yeah, man, how you doing? And he's like, well, you know, I actually do make space cookies, and I made two of them for you. And, you know, just be careful with them because they're pretty powerful. And, but I'm really looking forward. I brought my wife and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh man, bless your heart. Thanks for coming down and giving me these space cookies. That's great. So I'm standing backstage with Wilson McDermott, and he and I are, you know, we're drinking our beers and whatnot, and I look at these two space cookies and I'm like, well, maybe if I only ate one. And So I ate that space cookie while Wilson was doing, I think Wilson was featuring for me. So he had about a half an hour on stage. So I figured, okay, well, if I eat this space cookie now, I shouldn't peak until midway through my routine. So I should be able to do at least a half an hour of rehearsed stand-up before shit gets really weird. And sure enough, yeah, that's what I did. You know, I did my set and started doing, you know, the eye drunk routine and some other kind of rehearsed routines that I had. And then, you know, of course, a space cookie kicked in the middle of some bit I was doing about Donald Trump. And then I could feel the set going sideways on me. But I could also hear the audience laughing really hard as the set was going sideways on me. And so I decided to just kind of, I don't know, throw a saddle on my cerebral cortex and just ride my own imagination backwards through the rest of the set. And from what I heard from my sister and some other people in the audience, the set went well. I don't remember it, but I guess I guess there were some revelations and
wow.
some fun was had, but yeah, you know, I'm trying very hard to kind of walk away from that.
Yeah.
You know, there's always going to be a wee bit of that that follows you. I know anytime that I do a show at like Syracuse or Cornell or UVM or something like that, like the audience expects me to like get shit faced with them and do all these drugs and get really fucking crazy with them. And my whole thing is, at my age, I'm like, look, I'm happy to smoke a joint with anybody. I'm happy to do a few shots of Jameson. But what I can't do is get so shit-faced that I die on stage. You know, like sometimes it feels like the audience is like, yeah, go all the way. Belushi it out. I want to be there when you Belushi out. You know, like
Belushi out.
Never go full yeah. Belushi. Never
and
go
meanwhile,
full
like, meanwhile, when I'm at home by myself, I'm like on YouTube going like, well, that looks like a lovely house. I would love to live properly there.
Honey, where's my Earl Grey tea?
It's like Frank the Tank.
Yeah, yeah. you know, I would love to have Frank the Tank's options. My problem is, you know, every 3 or 4 years, whoever is the option for being my wife ends up being like, I can't handle this. This isn't what I signed up for. I'm covered in vomit. Where are your pants? You know, and that actually recently happened to me. I just broke up with my girlfriend of like 4 years about a month and a half ago, and it was a bit of a bummer. It was a necessary change, but it was a bit of a bummer because I'm getting to be that age, especially when I, you know, with certain comics that I work with, you know, they're married, they have kids, they have properties and whatnot, and here I am, you know, banging cocktail waitresses in Tampa and dropping acid. I mean,
wow,
it certainly has to make a negative impression. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
No, so, also Rick Adana is like my best friend.
He's one of the
probably the
nicest guy I met in comedy. He like welcomed me with open arms, and you know, here's a guy like you and him that have done a million things in comedy. I say it all the time. And Mark, you know, we don't talk about comedy. We talk about his kids and life.
Yeah,
and
he's such an amazing guy, dude. I fucking love Rick Adana, and an amazing actor. You know, one of the ways he and I actually first bonded was weird story is Mark Rick Adana and I had the same agent and the same manager, but at different times. So he and I have been hearing about each other for about 10 years before we actually met. So people kept being like, well, surely, you know, Sean Lynch. And he'd be like, no, I've heard of him. Yeah. And people would be like, oh, have you ever partied with Rick Adana? And I'm like, oh, no, but I hear he's a great guy to party with. And then about 4 years ago, we met at this roast for this comedian, Frank Vignola. And meanwhile, I had met his wife, who was a bartender at the time for a comedy club I used to hang out at. And she was also like, how do you not know my husband? And when we finally met and finally did a couple of shots together and finally started talking about music and football and whatnot, yes, by the end of that evening, we were the best friends everybody thought we would be. And but the coolest thing about Mark Rigodano was that night he was telling me about how he was an actor in addition to being a comedian and a writer and blah, blah. And I was like, oh, man, you know, I just got this money to direct this film that I wrote. It's called Game Night, and I'd love for you to come and audition for it. And he came and auditioned for it, and he knocked it out of the park so hard for one of the leads. You know, I ended up casting him in it. And then during the 3-4 months that it took us to film the movie, he kept saying to me, well, Lynch, have you ever done The Road? And I was like, no, you know, I never really hung out with guys that did The Road. I was always more of a city comic. I never really got into that whole road scene, but I was always a little curious about it. And Mark was like, well, let me take you out on the road with me. And, you know, you feature for me and we'll see if it's something you would like. And God damn, dude, I fucking loved it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
just a such a good dude, man. Such an awesome dude.
And he took me to out to Philly and Pittsburgh and Ohio and Virginia and San Antonio and Atlanta and everywhere all over the Eastern Seaboard. And I realized I really fucking loved it. One of the saddest days of my life was about a year ago or so when club owners started going, well, you should be headlining. And I thought, well, no, because the structure is Rigodano headlines and I feature, and I'm very happy with that. And that's if you want to pay me more to feature, that sounds great, but I don't want a headline. And then I realized that it was almost double the headline, so I had to start headlining, so which was kind of a bummer because, I mean, it's a weird it's a weird phase because you realize once you're headlining – like, now I can't open for Pat Dixon or Frank Mignola or Mark Rigodano or any of the people that I've enjoyed working with. Now I have to kind of be my own man, and now I have to find my own feature.
It's
an
interesting perspective, It's interesting. But on the other hand, I want to be like, oh, poor Sean, headlining all over the country.
No, no, no. But,
Scott, there's 2,500 people in the audience. They're all coming to see me headline.
No, but you know what's weird, dude? It's way more work and responsibility and not as fun in the end. Yeah. Like, when you're featuring, you have no responsibility for the ticket sales. You don't have to push merch at the end of the show.
It's true.
And you just get to go up there and be a rock star for a half an hour, get in, get out, get as hammered as you like, you know, everything's cool. When you're headlining, there's a bit of responsibility there. Yeah. Like, you have to make sure that who's ever opening for you is really going to do their due diligence on that half an hour. You have to be able to have some kind of merch to push at the end. You have to, and you can't, you know, when you're doing 45 minutes to an hour, you can't get shit-faced. Yeah, that's not an option.
No space
cakes.
You know,
you have to carry an hour. Yeah. And what I found, especially in the past year, is that at around the 45-minute mark, I'll start to have to resort to things like crowd work or just randomly talking about whatever's in my head. Because of that 45-minute mark, I get like, it's going to be a bit work. But so those guys who were headlining, you know, they're sweating their dicks off every night. Like, I know a lot of times as you're coming up, you're like, well, whatever, the feature gets to do whatever. And then when you're a feature, you're like, oh, well, the headliner gets to do whatever. But it is a lot of work.
Absolutely.
You know?
Sean, I don't want to take up all your time, but what's coming up for you other than the obvious being on The Walking Dead? What can we look forward to?
There's a couple of cool things that are happening right now that I'm really excited about. There's a short film that I wrote and produced that Patrick Kendall directed that me and Jason Scoop, who if you remember was the kid that won that Dana Carvey's First Impressions contest on TV. He and I started working together and we made this film that was basically it was basically just a proof reel for an MTV show that we're pushing called Social Injustice. But the producers were like, well, could you make one little tiny segment or sketch of you and Jason together so we get an idea of what you guys can do? So I called up Patrick Kendall, who is a director at MTV that I've worked with for years and worked on a lot of stuff with. And about a month and a half ago, we shot this short called Silence of the Ham that was basically Donald Trump hires Hannibal Lecter to be his campaign manager for November. And I played Hannibal Lecter and he played Donald Trump. Uh-huh. And we shot it in a day at the location that we had. And we sent it into MTV as like a proof of concept to them. But then just because I had won a few awards at a couple of other film festivals, I sent it out as its own short to a couple of film festivals. And we just won an award at the International Film Festival in Manhattan about a month ago. And they're going to be screening it at the Chelsea Film Festival in about 2 weeks. I think it's on the 18th. So I'm kind of excited about that because we're trying to get as much positive reviews of that short just to try and push the pilot. And I'm also working on a pilot for Netflix called Blue Wall, the series, which is about this racial incident that happens in this in New York City. And it's kind of based on the Central Park Five and that whole thing that happened in the 80s with those black kids that were unjustly accused of a murder of a woman. And it's actually a heavy, heavy drama, which is weird. But this woman that had met me a couple of years ago at the International Film Festival, Sheila Mitchell Simmons, who's writing and directing the series, ended up casting me as kind of, I guess you could say, the villain in the series. I play this sort of racist, drunk Irish cop that's really kind of horrible, but he's funny. He's sort of a Tom Sizemore type character.
All right, like, all right.
He's a son of a bitch, but he's funny, and he's a cop, and it's been kind of interesting shooting the scenes for that because we're actually shooting it in the actual Queens Correctional Facility, which is a live prison. I mean, it's a real prison. Nice. So while we're shooting these scenes in the prison, prison is fucking happening. You know, so these dudes are in their cells and they're doing their thing, and we're in these isolated little wings shooting our scenes, and they're yelling whatever. And that's here great. I am playing this like drunk Irish cop saying the N-word every other word, and it makes me a little nervous going in and going out of there. but that's awesome. A lot of fun. And you know, I'm looking forward to doing a bunch of comedy on the road in the next couple of weeks. I have to go back to Atlanta in about 10 days, and I got to finish shooting another scene.
All right, sorry, we're back. Go ahead. Yeah. So you were saying.
So I'm going to be doing a couple more. I'm really excited about. I don't know if you and I have spoke a few times. I do a lot of work for the Children's Brain Tumor Foundation.
Yes.
I was a kid who had an ocular melanoma when I was little. Really? And so I've always kind of had a soft spot for kids who are going through cancer treatment and whatnot. And about 3-4 years ago, I got tapped by a guy at the Friars Club to start hosting the Children's Brain Tumor Foundation's benefit there every year. And I've been doing it now for 4 years, and last year I had Rick Adana on the show, and this year I've got Hank Azaria and Jason Alexander on the show, which is kind of neat.
Wow. Nice.
Yeah, it's kind of cool. But the coolest thing that's happened is 3 years ago, this kid Kyle Kratzky, who had a brain tumor, came up to me after the show and was like, "Look, I want to be a comedian," and I was like, "Oh, it's great, man." He's like, "No, but I really do. Like, I want to do whatever it takes to become a comedian." So I talked to his parents and I said, "All right, look, if he's serious about this, let me take him to a couple of open mics in the Village, and I'll take him to a couple of open mics on the West Side, and we'll see what happens." And slowly but surely, you know, we started, you know, doing some open mics with him, and I started giving him some notes, and then suddenly he started playing Broadway, and suddenly started playing Comic Strip Live.
How cool
and,
is that?
Now he's kind of my sidekick on this benefit show that we're doing, and he also, when I do shows in Long Island, he's my feature, and,
wow.
And he's great. And out of that, some other comedians, Jack Clunan, and some other kids who have cancer who've since gone into stand up have also kind of joined our brigade, and we've been doing this. We've been doing these benefits at Broadway and awesome. The Strip, where we raise money for research, for cancer research for children that have these brain tumors. But I think the coolest thing that's come out of this is that these kids who are sick, who have these ailments, they get to see two, three, four sometimes comedians who were all kids who had cancer now up and pursuing their dreams and wow. doing what they wanted to do. And to me, that's like the yeah. most rewarding thing that I'm working. That's the thing that I'm most proud of. And I'm really excited that people like Hank Azaria and Jason Alexander and these other guys from the Friars Club want to get involved, because it's really important. You know, I think as important as raising money for what these kids are going through and helping their parents pay for chemo and stuff like that, I think it's incredibly important that these 6, 7, 8-year-old kids are seeing kids that had what they had becoming the guy on The Walking Dead
absolutely.
Or the guy like it, where they're like, oh, okay, so I'm not sick kid forever.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's awesome.
And I also kind of like, in a weird way, I was saying to one of the dads and one of the kids that we work with, I'm like, you know what? I kind of like that I kind of have this tarnished rep of being a party animal and like a womanizer or whatever it is, because at least these kids can watch and go, hey, I can be that, you know, I don't have to be this, because the thing that always pisses me off, and I've said this more than once to parents of kids in this program, is don't mollycoddle them. Don't be like, oh, my poor son, my poor daughter, my poor kid, because
yeah.
that doesn't do anything to help their self-esteem. You have to prove to them that, like, dude, your illness is like 10% of what you are.
Yeah.
There's another 90% that's awesome. There's another 90% that's going to get in a menage a trois. There's another 90% that's going to be opening up for Amy Schumer at, you know, Madison Square Garden. You know what I mean? Like, there's
that's tremendous, man. So where does everyone go to follow you or check you out? What's the best place
to check in? The thing that I do the most is Instagram. You can go to Geezer Lynch at Instagram. It's GEEZERLYNCH at Instagram. And also, if you go to Sean Lynch at, you know, Facebook, I'm on there, and pretty easy to spot.
All right, Mike Berlew, Sean Lynch, pretty damn cool, right? Like,
bad guy.
We made these lists before to, like, guys we should get on, like, thing we always said, like, someone from The Walking Dead, and inadvertently I work with the guy who ended up, apparently, what it sounds like, is going to be a character on a couple episodes of The Walking Dead.
Yeah, in the Walking Dead universe with the Telltale games.
I don't really know much about that, but...
Well, basically what they do, the first, Clementine is a little girl that met up with a guy, I forget the lead character's name, but he basically, where the Telltale games is it'll give you a scene and it'll let you select certain things you say to a person or what you do, and basically at the end of the game will determine who your friends are, who are not your friends, whether you die or not, something like that. And so basically everything you select determines how your game ends.
Yeah,
that's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty amazing, like, to be cast in that universe now. Like, I can't even imagine. Like, there's probably so much more to the lockdown and the mm-hmm. the thing that happened to you if you do reveal something, you know? Like, they'd probably just kill you.
Yeah,
it's probably
they'd
in the contract.
Literally just cut your head off and eat you, like,
be
at
funny if,
the Terminus.
It'd be funny if all the walkers were just actual people who...
Who, they really
who revealed,
made them, guys.
Who revealed secrets. but pretty damn cool. So you watched my dog this weekend while I went away.
Mm-hmm.
Today, Alex texted me, did you do this? And happened to be a picture of me and you from your...
Darn, I wanted to go a little longer than that.
From your game show, the 40th yeah. birthday party.
Yeah, me and Izzy well done. Were talking about it. I'm like, we'd like a scenario where we put a picture there and see how long it took. And I thought I had a good shot because it's all a bunch of bottles in front of it. I'm like, oh, they'll never recognize it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. So I laughed pretty hard. I'm like, no, I didn't do that, but I know exactly who did. And actually, it's funny because I had the same plan for you. I was going to put like... me like Photoshop me kissing you on your kissing wall, like I was gonna put it like in different places, but well done, buddy. Well, yeah, solid.
I gave it a shot. Yeah, it was an interesting weekend. The dog, we brought Obi over to the place, and as I talked about before, Callie's not a huge fan of other dogs. She seemed to get along with Obi fine, and they didn't get any fights or anything, but about 5 minutes in, okay, Obi's walking around looking at stuff. Me and the girl are sitting on the couch. All of a sudden, Callie goes, you know what? But I don't like this. And she pisses on the carpet.
Yeah, but you've had that same reaction many times before.
Yeah, but, you know, I at least inform everybody. I just go, I don't feel good. I'm going to pay the carpet. She just did it, you know? Mm-hmm. So I get mad, and I pick her up, and I put her in the other room, and I go to get the sponge to clean it up. As I come out, Obi just kind of looks at it, and he's like, oh, it's one of them days, and all, and he pisses on the carpet.
Well.
Pissing contest was on.
Yeah, like, I don't know, he never pees inside. Well, he does occasionally, but he doesn't pee on carpet too often at all. Mm. Like, he'll have an accident every once in a while, like, when, like, usually only at night. Like, if I leave him at night, and, like, we're out for a long time, then sometimes he'll have a small accident.
But, okay.
But never usually, like, just, like, blatantly, like, hey, I'm pissing. Yeah. You know.
It's like, oh, yeah? But then the entire weekend, they were good after that.
So. That's good. That's good. You look like you spoiled them and took them to
wineries. Most of the ideas was the girl, but... Why don't we... Okay.
Callie, your dog had a nice sweater on.
Yeah, again, the girl's idea. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, it's getting wintery. We need to put a sweater on a dog. It's a hunting dog. They're kind of bred for cold weather and stuff, you know. Like,
you think a dog knows they have a sweater on? Like, they're like, oh, what the fuck is this?
I'm not sure they know when you attempt to put them on. I'll tell you that much. That's a fun little excursion. Yeah. You figure they would just, like, make them with, like, Velcro or something like that. But nope, you got to grab the legs and be like, come on, let's put it through this leg hole. See how you like it.
Yeah, so it's pretty much meant to be that they don't like sweaters and ties. And
I mean, once she's in, she's kind of like, okay, whatever.
That's what she tells you. She's like, I'm good.
Yeah. Like, Dad, like, whatever.
Whatever. So that's the voice you've now created for your dog?
The girl mostly does it. I mean, she kept on begging me for a voice. I'm like, you know... To be brutally honest, like, the Obi voice was my generic dog voice. I didn't really look into, like, making 50 other voices as you... Uh-huh. Every dog we see, you know, give it a voice! Give it a voice!
You didn't have plans to be a dog impersonator, is what you're saying.
No. Just have, like, a generic dog voice, you know. When Obi sadly passes away and you get the next dog, it will still go, hello, Daddy!
Obi's not going to pass away.
Oh, okay.
He's going to live forever.
Titan. Hi, Bonnie. But yeah, took them both into Chester, our favorite little town. Went in Winky's Boutique. I don't make these names. Winky's Dog Boutique. As we were trying to find... Christmas hats for the dogs, and they didn't really have any hats, so
your man card has not only just been revoked, it's been destroyed, burnt,
expired. Yeah.
I'm
not sure if I'm gonna be allowed to like leave the state. I'll show my ID and they're like, sir, North Carolina doesn't approve of you.
You're going to Winkies, you're putting sweaters on your dog, you're shopping for Christmas hats.
Yeah. They didn't have any.
It's over, buddy. Just hang it. Hang your testicles on the wall.
Next to the kissing wall.
Bad enough she took your whole apartment and made it to Berlew and Izzy Factory.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're shopping for dog hats. Yeah,
so they didn't have any, but Obi really liked this one set of bones, and I think it's like cheese infused or something like that. So we got her and Callie a bone. Then we went to another store that she loves, and she's like, "Oh, I'm going to go shopping." So I had to sit outside on the outside porch, holding on to the dogs as every other person goes by and all
well,
tells me.
Well, it's
how
interesting
lovely.
Because you used to go sit on that porch and wait for dogs, mm-hmm. you know, by yourself. So at least you looked relatively normal.
Yeah. And every person, "Oh, how cute. What a beautiful sweater." I'm like, "Yeah, thank you. Thank you."
They're talking about the one you were wearing?
No, it was a dog.
What a beautiful sweater. Give me a break.
And then we went to Allstead Farms.
That's like a that has like goats and stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah. I was trying to the list. They have pigs. I was hoping to go there with a carrot, but I can't find any of them. So, but do you still know the name of that farm? I'd like.
Yeah,
to
I know somewhere we can go.
Okay, okay. Yep. We'll try to see if they still have pigs out and try that. But in any case, maybe after I do six Smirnoff and kick field.
That we just got to do. That's just
yeah,
a funny
that has
YouTube
to be done.
That one's got to be done.
But we went there, we did some wine tasting, and I will say Callie was good with, like, a small dog for once. She didn't try to bite its face off, so.
Right.
But it's like we're trying to get wine, and at the same time, Obi has one leash, which is shorter than Callie's. He's going in one direction. She just, second I concentrate on him, she goes, "Okay, let me try the other direction," and half the day, I'm getting drunk trying to hold on to two dogs. It doesn't really work out that well.
No, but I feel like before this all happened, that was like one of your fantasies. I just want to get drunk and hold two dogs.
Oh, the good old days. Man, oof.
Yeah.
Get some moonshine and a couple Wattweilers. Yeah.
A couple Wattweilers?
Yeah.
They're different than Rottweilers.
Yeah, man.
Interesting.
They're like Mantars.
Interestingly enough, I heard you were a Wattweiler expert. How are they different than what we know as a Rottweiler?
Well, they're very uniquely the same and yet different. I mean, that's the best way to describe it.
Of course, of course.
First of all, the Wattweilers, they like to have one ear up and one ear kind of floppy.
One ear up, one ear down. So half a flop ear is what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the way they bred, you know. They wanted the one ear extra strong to hear criminals who are in the area.
Okay, and the other ear down for...
Well, that's just to strengthen the one ear. They don't really need the second ear. The first ear compensates for the second ear and gets 10 times stronger.
So, but like through evolution, wouldn't they just get rid of that shitty ear over time?
It goes back to like the 1700s with the queen. I mean, she needed that perfect amount of security, and that's what their belief system was.
It's unbelievable. And how again did you become an expert on the Wattweiler?
Well, you know, I mean, as I started as a vet tech when I was around 16, I talked to a fellow vet, and he informed me about, you know, different fields of dog knowledge that you can go out and get.
Right.
And he said that, you know, it's kind of like in college. You don't just get a bachelor's degree. Uh-huh. You get a bachelor's with a major in.
Okay.
So I started investigating my dog knowledge, and he's like, "Well, you really need to concentrate on one breed so you have a major when you graduate."
Right.
And it was... as I looked around, I mean, I could have went with some generic breeds. I could have put down the recorder as I was explaining it. Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what happened in the Peyton Manning dream I had. We were interviewing Peyton Manning, and you came in and demolished the recorder.
But I didn't yell Omaha this time. But, yeah, as I looked at other breeds, I looked at different zones of areas with dogs in it, and I wanted to get something.
Hear that?
Special.
That's the sound of steam running
yeah,
out.
Yeah.
Now, tell
is
us.
Steve Lynch there yet?
Sean.
Oh.
Stephen Lynch was the comedian with the guitar.
Yeah.
So,
are we getting him?
What are the main differences between a Wattweiler, like appearance-wise, other than the ear?
They have an extra set of teeth.
An extra, yeah. A whole extra set.
Yeah, behind it. So they're even more vicious when you train them as an attack.
So if they bite you and they get a good chomp, they have a whole backup set. Wow. Yeah.
If you punch out the front set, the back set is still there to get into them.
That's unbelievable how much you know about the Rottweiler.
Their tail is slightly thinner, but 5 inches longer than a Rottweiler.
Five. Every time.
The queen was very specific about that when they were breeding them.
Interesting. Now, if I was to own a Rottweiler puppy, what should I feed it? Like, what does the diet consist of in a Rottweiler?
Kale. Horse corn. Horse corn is very important.
See, now, I'm confused. They have all these teeth, but yet they seem to be vegetarians.
Well, you know, I mean, when they're puppies, you have to strengthen those teeth because, you know, puppy teeth fall out like baby teeth.
Uh-huh.
So you need to, you know, ease them into that desire for meat.
Now, if one was to ease a Rottweiler into the desire for meat, where would they begin?
Well, like I said, I mean, first you start with the kale and horse corn diet.
Kale and horse corn diet.
Yeah, that's very important.
I think that's what you need to go on.
Yeah. Next year's shenanigan challenge.
1 week of kale and horse corn. right back into
And then you slowly get them into like the softer dog foods.
Naturally.
Yeah, I prefer a veal kind of a dog food because I mean that entices
veal dog food that has veal. To be pricey.
Yeah, I mean it's a queen's dog.
Okay,
come on, you think the queen is feeding the royal dogs cheap dog food? As it has one flop ear and it's listening for burglars?
No, this is the Queen of England.
No, Belgium.
Queen of Belgium.
Yeah.
Interestingly enough, I also heard you're an expert on Belgium's hierarchy of, monarchs and stuff. So the Queen of Belgium, I know nothing about the topic. I'll admit, I don't know a thing. So I thought maybe
we have a lot in common. Yeah, but go on.
You know, maybe you could tell us about the Queen of Belgium, how that works.
Well, it started. It actually started way later than the, the royal ships of England. It actually started around the 20th century. That soon. I mean, Belgium was a country just known for like waffles, and they really wanted to take that step above. So they decided not just to have, like, a regular, like, vote or something like that. Let's start a royal family now. So they had one last vote to determine who would be the royal family of all Belgium.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And it was won by the Swastowicks.
That sounds almost like swastika.
No. Totally different.
Okay. The Swastowicks, okay. Interesting. Where were they from?
Oddly enough, Finland.
So you don't have to be born in Belgium to be the Queen of Belgium.
It was one last vote. They're like, you know, whoever's cool enough. We'll
okay,
pick.
All right.
Yeah.
So now, is it done by public vote or they just picked one?
Electoral college, just like America.
Electoral college
for
the Queen of Belgium.
Yeah.
Well, what was her name again?
That would be Samantha Swastika.
But you said it was wasn't a swastika.
Well, that was her maiden name.
Her maiden name was Swastika, and she married into the Swastowicz's or whatever. Wow, that's kind of a coincidence. So she didn't really have to change her name too much.
Not really. I mean, the key thing was, like, after she won the election, she said, we really have to grow the royal family, so I have to get married and breed more so this royal family can go on for generation to generation.
So who'd she marry?
John Clark.
John Clark is the King of Belgium.
Well, he doesn't really get the kingship. He just gets to show up there. You know?
Now, the Queen of Belgium, how did she start to find her love of Rottweilers?
As of recent times, you know, there's a lot of crimes in Belgium. And, I mean, a lot of
I think Belgium's supposed to be pretty safe.
Well, you would think. Well, it's now because of all the dogs.
Because of so the Rottweilers roam the streets, is what you're saying, of Belgium.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Belgium is now known as a town for their waffles, their great beer, and vicious dogs roaming the street with one pointy ear.
Well, I mean, they're protect dogs. They're only vicious to those who try to harm Belgium.
Now, interestingly enough, who tries to harm Belgium?
Bulgaria.
Bulgaria.
Yeah.
Those bastards. Mm-hmm, exactly. Now, when you were in Bulgaria, did you notice
that? Oh, they always talked about Belgium. They have a thing. I don't even get it. Like, they tried to tell me some story. It had something to do with, like, football. Not American football. Their football.
Okay.
And
now, interestingly enough, I heard that you are also an expert on Bulgarian football, which is different than American mm-hmm. football and different than soccer, from what I hear.
Yeah.
It's Bulgarian football.
Uh-huh.
I seem
to know a lot.
So why not for our audience? Because we don't get a lot of Bulgarian football players on the cast. We've mm-hmm. tried. They're just very, you know, they're like recluses. They're very shut in.
We'll
they're very
back
committed.
To this in a minute. Just as a side note, they actually have a Bulgarian American football league out there.
Oh, okay.
But go back to my knowledge base.
But Bulgarian football. We tried to have guys on from Bulgarian football, but the rules are completely different. Correct.
Yeah, it is way different. I mean, they're not a part of FIFA one outs because their rules are just absolutely insane. The fields are only 37 yards in length.
Only 37 yards?
Yeah, yeah. And they play in quicksand.
They play in quicksand, so the field's always sinking.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, the goals are pretty deep. They go all the way to the bottom, so the goals don't sink. That would really make it weird.
Now, how deep are we talking? Like, people die all the time?
You know, there's been some greats that sadly got lost because of the quicksand fair. But, you know, it's for the love of the game.
Now, the object of Bulgarian football is what?
To get the most quintines as possible.
Quintines?
Yeah.
What's a quintine?
Well, basically what happens is you have to bounce the football on your forehead, and you have to try to swim across in the quicksand and put the ball over the net.
With your head?
Yes.
So
kind of like a seal.
So when you watch Bulgarian football, it's basically just see a bunch of men up to their necks with footballs on their head trying to throw it through mm-hmm. goals.
Yeah.
All right. Now, who is the reigning champions of Bulgarian football?
That would be CSKA.
CSKA, which obviously stands for...
Collective Somewhat Kilworths... Above.
That's a very interesting name for a sports team.
Yeah.
Maybe, wait, just for everyone listening at home, why don't you repeat the name of the team so they can look them up?
Pass.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, what that's called is when we don't have anything to talk about. Uh-huh. And
Scott just forces me to say stuff.
Well, I formed a new thing where, like, when you make a brutal mistake, that uh-huh. I just now you've become a historian on it. And wow,
better than drunk history.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very good. Bulgarian football. They play quicksand, bounce balls on their head. And all right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a hard segue right there. But I went to Lake George, my little happy spot for the week. Well, not the week, for a day, really, Saturday to Sunday afternoon. We
what
left.
What course you to just do that, like a one-day trip?
What was that? What did I, what?
What made you decide to just do like a one-day trip?
I love the area. Obviously, I've been there a bunch of times. You know that. But everyone thinks of like where we are. Lake George is so far away. It's 3-hour drive. So like... Mm-hmm. You know, people go to AC all the time for a night from up here. That's about 3 hours, 2 hours and 45 minutes, you know, 2.5 hour. People go to Cape May all the time for a day. And, you know, I just wanted to get up and get away and go do something fun. And the brewery, Adirondack Brewery, which can be heard on episode 116, I think. But they had a little event, a pumpkin chunking event. Okay. And, like, they were shooting pumpkins at these giant Trump and Hillary faces. Mm-hmm. So it was a lot of fun, and we just decided to get up there. We pulled a lot of stuff off in one day. Now, up there in this time of year is pretty much like a ghost town. Mm-hmm. Like, only like the cool things are kind of open. Like, it's very like local vibe, and it's a lot of fun. But we ended up going to breakfast. We took a drive.
So 3 hours for breakfast.
Yeah. It's like
Santel.
No, it's like Johnny Watson and.
Oh, yeah, the blueberry pancakes.
Yeah, from
Golden Corral.
Golden Corral, yeah, yeah. but, yeah, we went to
Johnny,
that.
We're no longer in Maryland right now.
Delaware for pancakes. Yeah, we did that. We went to the brewery, had a couple of drinks, went to the winery. We went on a hunt for this coffee that we really like. We drove like 25 minutes north where I vacationed with my family in the summer just to get in, and it wasn't there. So I'm like, oh, it's not there. And Alex goes rummaging through the can, like, oh my God, it's not there, like pulling bags out and all that. But eventually they did have a bag of it in the back, and they made it three bags for us, which was kind of cool.
So oh, that's sweet.
It is a good coffee. And then, like, I don't know, we went back to the brewery, had dinner, and by that time you're dead by like 9 o'clock, 9:30. We went back and fell asleep. Not before Alex made me get dessert. We had to pull over to a Stewart's, and she had to get not ice cream, like a full brownie sundae. Like, the guy was even surprised. She's like, can I get a brownie sundae? She said, you want the brownie sundae? It's like 10 o'clock or 9:30, you know? And he had to, like, go get a brownie from the back and, like, microwave it. And it came in, like, one of those, like, it looked like a gravy boat of ice cream. And, but, yeah, and then we got up, we left, we came back down, and we stopped at Orange County Choppers just to check it out on the way home.
I've been there before.
Yeah, I've never been there.
I was there for a concert.
Oh, cool, yeah. I've never been there. I passed it 10 million times. I'm like, you know what, this time I'm going to check it out. And it was, like, all the bikes I remember from the show. And I liked the show a lot. Actually, I tried to contact all of them today, like every cast member, to see if they'll come on the cast. So hopefully we'll get somebody.
Oh, cool.
You saw a couple of the bikes. It's basically, it's such a definitely tourist trap. Like it's like the Hard Rock Cafe now. Yeah. It's like t-shirts and the bikes. Oh, is that me? Maybe. No, that's you. Must You're vibrating, bro.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I think.
Probably all my Bulgarian friends. Tell me I forgot some stuff.
Don't forget to tell them what happens when you lose. Yeah, it was a good weekend, man. And now I look forward to the Grand Canyon on Wednesday Well, funny story about that.
Go ahead.
I am. We're sitting here and we're going over. We're just talking about like our plan, like how we're going to get the dog. And I look up the reservations, and I, Captain Asshole, booked the wrong flight home.
Oh.
So now we're coming back on Saturday rather than Sunday. It was like $1,000 to change flights. Like, you know,
yeah,
it's like,
they rake you over a coal.
I was like, you know what, for $1,000, we'll go back, like, if we want to spend more time.
A funny thing. It's just like, I can do another trip for the one day you're going
to
give me.
They're so bad. They're like, okay, it's $200 each to cancel it. I'm like, $200 to cancel? Someone's going to buy that ticket. Like, and I'm not asking to cancel. I'm just asking for a different flight. Roll it into another flight if there's a spot. But just a crime. The airlines are such a crime. But
yeah, I got to get like an Uber or a taxi for my flight over to North Carolina on Monday.
Yeah. Yeah, we're probably going to Uber it too to the airport. But yeah, I kind of messed up on that. I felt pretty bad about that one. But, yeah, it is what it is.
You could have lost enough weight in that Saturday to ride a mule.
I know. I actually did the mule bit on stage last night. It went over pretty damn well for the first time. It actually probably hit harder than my normal jokes, which is a good sign, I guess. But
well, it's kind of relatable at the same time, very weird, you know?
Yeah. It's definitely weird, and I think I've put on some good spins on it. It actually came from the last week's episode where we were talking. I listened back. I'm like, oh, I kind of like that, you know, just talking. So actually, the podcast has provided a lot of material, through, like just by flushing things out. Let's get out of here, Berlin. Let's get out of here. Solid episode of the podcast, and hopefully some big things to come. Hopefully, judging by Twitter.
Yeah.
All right, Berlin, anything to promote?
I will promote our friend AG Mattioli. Words.
Who's that?
That is the LGBTQ director of the great documentary Words, an Exploration of Identity. He's got a documentary screening down in New York on December 3rd at Broadway Comedy Club. Go to eventbrite.com for tickets to go see that. I'll quickly say the facebook.com/TheBurl721 tonight on The Walking Dead. Last week I had this last episode I had a pretty good turnout for people. A little spoof of every episode. Maybe I'll spoof Max.
Maybe, but maybe more importantly for the audience that loves Berlew,
nobody
where the hell is Pumpkin Spice, whatever, the finale.
The finale will be coming It will be coming this week. I got the product. It's a long story on how it got there. Hell, I built some drama to it.
Don't let the audience
Day
down,
31.
Buddy. Don't let the
will
audience
come.
Down. I'll just promote quickly Tap House 15. Lagunitas beer sampling, Tap Takeover beforehand, Mike Gaffney headlining, Andy Hayward, Jackie Byrne hosting, Kevin Gauthier, no longer Mike Berlow, he's away on business.
Sorry, people.
But your boy, me, will be stepping in. Well, I was going to do time anyway, so it's not a real real shocking thing. But yeah, other than that, guys, we need you to subscribe, and we need you to leave reviews, and we need you to share the podcast with your friend. If you
oh,
like
yeah,
what
listen,
you hear.
If you could. That'd
yeah,
be
yeah.
great.
Yeah, if you like what you hear and all that fun stuff. So please help us out. Leave a review. You can listen to us iTunes, Stitcher. Follow us on Instagram at Verbal Shenanigans. Follow us at Twitter at VS Comedy. Please help us out. Life is punny. Life is punny.
It's punny.
Life is punny, people.
Tom Mongelli?
Yeah. I worked with Tom last night. Life is funny, people. Laugh at it. Keep the wind at your back.
Is that the Hulk theme?
Maybe. It says Walking Dead theme song. Maybe it starts off in us.
Oh.
Maybe.
Do we have to fill time now? Until it gets to the good part?
Oh, it's like
oh
piano
okay. It's a piano one. I like it.
All right, cool. We'll go out on this.